7. Memory Overload. Evolution did not endow humans with the ability to play pick-up basketball. True, it produced legs for running, hands for dribbling, and shoulders for fouling, but all that this enables us to do is shoot hoops by ourselves. To get into a game with the strangers we find in the schoolyard on any given afternoon, we not only have to work in concert with four teammates we may never have met before, we also need to know that the five players on the opposing team are playing by the same rules. Other animals that engage strangers in ritualized aggression do so largely by instinct. Puppies throughout the world have the rules for rough-and-tumble play hardwired into their genes. But American teenagers have no genes for pick-up basketball. They can, nevertheless, play the game with complete strangers. They have all learned an identical set of ideas about basketball. These ideas are entirely imaginary, but if everyone shares them, we can all play the game. The same applies, on a larger scale, to kingdoms, churches, and trade networks, with one important difference. The rules of basketball are relatively simple and concise, much like those necessary for cooperation in a forager band or small village. Each player can easily store them in his brain and still have room for songs, images, and shopping lists. But large systems of cooperation that involve not 10, but thousands or even millions of humans require the handling and storage of huge amounts of information, much more than any single human brain can contain and process. The large societies found in some other species, such as ants and bees, are stable and resilient because most of the information needed to sustain them is encoded in the genome. A female honeybee larva can, for example, grow up to be either a queen or a worker, depending on what food it is fed. Its DNA programs the necessary behaviors for whatever role it will fulfill in life. Hives can be very complex social structures containing many different kinds of workers, such as harvesters, nurses, and cleaners. But so far, researchers have failed to locate lawyer bees. Bees don't need lawyers, because there is no danger that they might forget or violate the hive constitution. The queen does not cheat the cleaner bees of their food, and they never go on strike demanding higher wages. But humans do such things all the time. Because the sapiens' social order is imagined, humans cannot preserve the critical information for running it simply by making copies of their DNA and passing these on to their progeny. A conscious effort has to be made to sustain laws, customs, procedures, and manners, otherwise the social order would quickly collapse. For example, King Hammurabi decreed that people are divided into superiors, commoners, and slaves. Unlike the beehive class system, this is not a natural division. There is no trace of it in the human genome. If the Babylonians could not keep this truth in mind, their society would have ceased to function. Similarly, when Hammurabi passed his DNA to his offspring, it did not encode his ruling that a superior man who killed a commoner woman must pay 30 silver shekels. Hammurabi deliberately had to instruct his sons in the laws of his empire, and his sons and grandsons had to do the same. Empires generate huge amounts of information. Beyond laws, empires have to keep accounts of transactions and taxes, inventories of military supplies and merchant vessels, and calendars of festivals and victories. For millions of years, people stored information in a single place, their brains. Unfortunately, the human brain is not a good storage device for empire-sized databases for three main reasons. First, its capacity is limited. True, some people have astonishing memories, and in ancient times there were memory professionals who could store in their heads the topographies of whole provinces and the law codes of entire states. Nevertheless, there is a limit that even master mnemonists cannot transcend. A lawyer might know by heart the entire law code of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but not the details of every legal proceeding that took place in Massachusetts from the Salem witch trials onward. Secondly, humans die, and their brains die with them. Any information stored in a brain will be erased in less than a century. It is, of course, possible to pass memories from one brain to another, but after a few transmissions, the information tends to get garbled or lost. Thirdly, and most importantly, the human brain has been adapted to store and process only particular types of information. In order to survive, ancient hunter-gatherers had to remember the shapes, qualities, and behavior patterns of thousands of plant and animal species. They had to remember that a wrinkled yellow mushroom growing in autumn under an elm tree is most probably poisonous, whereas a similar-looking mushroom growing in winter under an oak tree is a good stomachache remedy. Hunter-gatherers also had to bear in mind the opinions and relations of several dozen band members. If Lucy needed a band member's help to get John to stop harassing her, it was important for her to remember that John had fallen out last week with Mary, who would thus be a likely and enthusiastic ally. Consequently, evolutionary pressures have adapted the human brain to store immense quantities of botanical, zoological, topographical, and social information. But when particularly complex societies began to appear in the wake of the agricultural revolution, a completely new type of information became vital: numbers. Foragers were never obliged to handle large amounts of mathematical data. No forager needed to remember, say, the number of fruit on each tree in the forest. So human brains did not adapt to storing and processing numbers. Yet, in order to maintain a large kingdom, mathematical data was vital. It was never enough to legislate laws and tell stories about guardian gods. One also had to collect taxes. In order to tax hundreds of thousands of people, it was imperative to collect data about people's incomes and possessions, data about payments made, data about arrears, debts, and fines, data about discounts and exemptions. This added up to millions of data bits, which had to be stored and processed. Without this capacity, the state would never know what resources it had and what further resources it could tap. When confronted with the need to memorize, recall, and handle all these numbers, most human brains overdosed or fell asleep. This mental limitation severely constrained the size and complexity of human collectives. When the amount of people and property in a particular society crossed a critical threshold, it became necessary to store and process large amounts of mathematical data. Since the human brain could not do it, the system collapsed. For thousands of years after the agricultural revolution, human social networks remained relatively small and simple. The first to overcome the problem were the ancient Sumerians, who lived in southern Mesopotamia. There, a scorching sun beating upon rich, muddy plains produced plentiful harvests and prosperous towns. As the number of inhabitants grew, so did the amount of information required to coordinate their affairs. Between the years 3500 BC and 3000 BC, some unknown Sumerian geniuses invented a system for storing and processing information outside their brains, one that was custom-built to handle large amounts of mathematical data. The Sumerians thereby released their social order from the limitations of the human brain, opening the way for the appearance of cities, kingdoms, and empires. The data processing system invented by the Sumerians is called writing. Signed, Kushim. Writing is a method for storing information through material signs. The Sumerian writing system did so by combining two types of signs, which were pressed in clay tablets. One type of signs represented numbers. There were signs for 1, 10, 60, 600, 3,600, and 36,000. The Sumerians used a combination of base 6 and base 10 numeral systems. Their base 6 system bestowed on us several important legacies, such as the division of the day into 24 hours and of the circle into 360 degrees. The other type of signs represented people, animals, merchandise, territories, dates, and so forth. By combining both types of signs, the Sumerians were able to preserve far more data than any human brain could remember or any DNA chain could encode. At this early stage, writing was limited to facts and figures. The great Sumerian novel, if there ever was one, was never committed to clay tablets. Writing was time-consuming and the reading public tiny, so no one saw any reason to use it for anything other than essential record-keeping. If we look for the first words of wisdom reaching us from our ancestors 5,000 years ago, we're in for a big disappointment. The earliest messages our ancestors have left us read, for example, 29,086 measures barley, 37 months kushim. The most probable reading of this sentence is, a total of 29,086 measures of barley were received over the course of 37 months, signed kushim. Alas, the first texts of history contain no philosophical insights, no poetry, legends, laws, or even royal triumphs. They are humdrum economic documents, recording the payment of taxes, the accumulation of debts, and the ownership of property. Only one other type of text survived from these ancient days, and it is even less exciting. Lists of words, copied over and over again by apprentice scribes as training exercises. Even had a bored student wanted to write out some of his poems instead of copy a bill of sale, he could not have done so. The earliest Sumerian writing was a partial rather than a full script. Full script is a system of material signs that can represent spoken language more or less completely. It can therefore express everything people can say, including poetry. Partial script, on the other hand, is a system of material signs that can represent only particular types of information, belonging to a limited field of activity. Latin script, ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics, and Braille are full scripts. You can use them to write tax registers, love poems, history books, food recipes, and business law. In contrast, the earliest Sumerian script, like modern mathematical symbols and musical notation, are partial scripts. You can use mathematical script to make calculations, but you cannot use it to write love poems. It didn't disturb the Sumerians that their script was ill-suited for writing poetry. They didn't invent it in order to copy spoken language, but rather to do things that spoken language failed at. There were some cultures, such as those of the pre-Columbian Andes, which used only partial scripts throughout their entire histories, unfazed by their script's limitations and feeling no need for a full version. Andean script was very different from its Sumerian counterpart. In fact, it was so different that many people would argue it wasn't a script at all. It was not written on clay tablets or pieces of paper. Rather, it was written by tying knots on colorful cords, called quipus. Each quipu consisted of many cords of different colors, made of wool or cotton. On each cord, several knots were tied in different places. A single quipu could contain hundreds of cords and thousands of knots. By combining different knots on different cords with different colors, it was possible to record large amounts of mathematical data relating to, for example, tax collection and property ownership. For hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, quipus were essential to the businesses of cities, kingdoms, and empires. They reached their full potential under the Inca Empire, which ruled 10 to 12 million people and covered today's Peru, Ecuador, and Bolivia, as well as chunks of Chile, Argentina, and Colombia. Thanks to quipus, the Incas could save and process large amounts of data, without which they would not have been able to maintain the complex administrative machinery that an empire of that size requires. In fact, quipus were so effective and accurate that in the early years following the Spanish conquest of South America, the Spaniards themselves employed quipus in the work of administering their new empire. The problem was that the Spaniards did not themselves know how to record and read quipus, making them dependent on local professionals. The continent's new rulers realized that this placed them in a tenuous position. The native quipu experts could easily mislead and cheat their overlords. So, once Spain's dominion was more firmly established, quipus were phased out, and the new empire's records were kept entirely in Latin script and numerals. Very few quipus survived the Spanish occupation, and most of those remaining are undecipherable, since, unfortunately, the art of reading quipus has been lost. The wonders of bureaucracy. The Mesopotamians eventually started to want to write down things other than monotonous mathematical data. Between 3000 BC and 2500 BC, more and more signs were added to the Sumerian system, gradually transforming it into a full script that we today call cuneiform. By 2500 BC, kings were using cuneiform to issue decrees, priests were using it to record oracles, and less exalted citizens were using it to write personal letters. At roughly the same time, Egyptians developed another full script known as hieroglyphics. Other full scripts were developed in China around 1200 BC and in Central America around 1000 to 500 BC. From these initial centers, full scripts spread far and wide, taking on various new forms and novel tasks. People began to write poetry, history books, romances, dramas, prophecies, and cookbooks. Yet writing's most important task continued to be the storage of reams of mathematical data, and that task remained the prerogative of partial script. The Hebrew Bible, the Greek Iliad, the Hindu Mahabharata, and the Buddhist Tipitaka all began as oral works. For many generations they were transmitted orally, and would have lived on even had writing never been invented. But tax registries and complex bureaucracies were born together with partial script, and the two remain inexorably linked to this day, like Siamese twins. Think of the cryptic entries in computerized databases and spreadsheets. As more and more things were written, and particularly as administrative archives grew to huge proportions, new problems appeared. Individuals can easily retrieve information stored in their own minds. My brain stores billions of bits of data, yet I can quickly, almost instantaneously, recall the name of Italy's capital, immediately afterwards recollect what I did on 11 September 2001, and then reconstruct the route leading from my house to the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Exactly how the brain does it remains a mystery, but we all know that the brain's retrieval system is amazingly efficient, except when you are trying to remember where you put your car keys. How, though, do you find and retrieve information stored on quipu cords or clay tablets? If you have just 10 tablets or 100 tablets, it's not a problem. But what if you have accumulated thousands of them, as did one of Hammurabi's contemporaries, King Zimrilim of Mari? Imagine for a moment that it's 1776 BC. Two Marians are quarreling over possession of a wheat field. Jacob insists that he bought the field from Esau 30 years ago. Esau retorts that he, in fact, rented the field to Jacob for a term of 30 years, and that now, the term being up, he intends to reclaim it. They shout and wrangle and start pushing one another before they realize that they can resolve their dispute by going to the royal archive, where are housed the deeds and bills of sale that apply to all the kingdom's real estate. Upon arriving at the archive, they are shuttled from one official to the other. They wait through several herbal tea breaks, are told to come back tomorrow, and eventually are taken by a grumbling clerk to look for the relevant clay tablet. The clerk opens a door and leads them into a huge room, lined floor to ceiling, with thousands of clay tablets. No wonder the clerk is sour-faced. How is he supposed to locate the deed to the disputed wheat field written 30 years ago? Even if he finds it, how will he be able to cross-check to ensure that the one from 30 years ago is the latest document relating to the field in question? If he can't find it, does that prove that Esau never sold or rented out the field? Or just that the document got lost, or turned to mush when some rain leaked into the archive? Clearly, just imprinting a document in clay is not enough to guarantee efficient, accurate, and convenient data processing. That requires methods of organization like catalogs, methods of reproduction like photocopy machines, methods of rapid and accurate retrieval like computer algorithms, and pedantic, but hopefully cheerful, librarians who know how to use these tools. Inventing such methods proved to be far more difficult than inventing writing. Many writing systems developed independently in cultures distant in time and place from each other. Every decade, archaeologists discover another few forgotten scripts. Some of them might prove to be even older than the Sumerian scratches in clay. But most of them remain curiosities, because those who invented them failed to invent efficient ways of cataloging and retrieving data. What set apart Sumer, as well as Pharaonic Egypt, ancient China, and the Inca Empire, is that these cultures developed good techniques of archiving, cataloguing, and retrieving written records. They obviously had no computers or photocopying machines, but they did have catalogues, and far more importantly, they did create special schools in which professional scribes, clerks, librarians, and accountants were rigorously trained in the secrets of data processing. A writing exercise from a school in ancient Mesopotamia discovered by modern archaeologists gives us a glimpse into the lives of these students some 4,000 years ago. I went in and sat down, and my teacher read my tablet. He said, "There's something missing," and he caned me. One of the people in charge said, "Why did you open your mouth without my permission?" And he caned me. The one in charge of rules said, "Why did you get up without my permission?" And he caned me. The gatekeeper said, "Why are you going out without my permission?" And he caned me. The keeper of the beer jug said, "Why did you get some without my permission?" And he caned me. The Sumerian teacher said, "Why did you speak Akkadian?" And he caned me. My teacher said, "Your handwriting is no good," and he caned me. Ancient scribes learned not merely to read and write, but also to use catalogues, dictionaries, calendars, forms, and tables. They studied and internalized techniques of cataloguing, retrieving and processing information very different from those used by the brain. In the brain, all data is freely associated. When I go with my spouse to sign on for a mortgage for our new home, I am reminded of the first place we lived together, which reminds me of our honeymoon in New Orleans, which reminds me of alligators, which remind me of dragons, which remind me of the Ring of the Nibelungen, and suddenly, before I know it, there I am humming the Siegfried leitmotif to a puzzled bank clerk. In bureaucracy, things must be kept apart. There is one drawer for home mortgages, another for marriage certificates, a third for tax registers, and a fourth for lawsuits. Otherwise, how can you find anything? Things that belong in more than one drawer, like Wagnerian music dramas, do I file them under music, theatre, or perhaps invent a new category altogether, are a terrible headache. So one is forever adding, deleting, and rearranging drawers. In order to function, the people who operate such a system of drawers must be reprogrammed to stop thinking as humans and to start thinking as clerks and accountants. As everyone from ancient times till today knows, clerks and accountants think in a non-human fashion. They think like filing cabinets. This is not their fault. If they don't think that way, their drawers will all get mixed up, and they won't be able to provide the services their government, company, or organization requires. The most important impact of script on human history is precisely this. It has gradually changed the way humans think and view the world. Free association and holistic thought have given way to compartmentalization and bureaucracy. The language of numbers. As the centuries passed, bureaucratic methods of data processing grew ever more different from the way humans naturally think, and ever more important. A critical step was made sometime before the 9th century AD, when a new partial script was invented, one that could store and process mathematical data with unprecedented efficiency. This partial script was composed of 10 signs, representing the numbers from 0 to 9. Confusingly, these signs are known as Arabic numerals, even though they were first invented by the Hindus. Even more confusingly, modern Arabs use a set of digits that look quite different from Western ones. But the Arabs get the credit because when they invaded India, they encountered the system, understood its usefulness, refined it, and spread it through the Middle East and then to Europe. When several other signs were later added to the Arab numerals, such as the signs for addition, subtraction, and multiplication, the basis of modern mathematical notation came into being. Although this system of writing remains a partial script, it has become the world's dominant language. Almost all states, companies, organizations, and institutions, whether they speak Arabic, Hindi, English, or Norwegian, use mathematical script to record and process data. Every piece of information that can be translated into mathematical script is stored, spread, and processed with mind-boggling speed and efficiency. A person who wishes to influence the decisions of governments, organizations, and companies must therefore learn to speak in numbers. Experts do their best to translate even ideas such as poverty, happiness, and honesty into numbers. The poverty line, subjective well-being levels, credit rating. Entire fields of knowledge, such as physics and engineering, have already lost almost all touch with the spoken human language and are maintained solely by mathematical script. More recently, mathematical script has given rise to an even more revolutionary writing system, a computerized binary script, consisting of only two signs, 0 and 1. The words I am now typing on my keyboard are written within my computer by different combinations of 0 and 1. Writing was born as the maidservant of human consciousness, but is increasingly becoming its master. Our computers have trouble understanding how Homo sapiens talks, feels, and dreams. So we are teaching Homo sapiens to talk, feel, and dream in the language of numbers, which can be understood by computers. And this is not the end of the story. The field of artificial intelligence is seeking to create a new kind of intelligence based solely on the binary script of computers. Science fiction movies, such as The Matrix and The Terminator, tell of a day when the binary script throws off the yoke of humanity. When humans try to regain control of the rebellious script, it responds by attempting to wipe out the human race.